Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Les Rowe, and I'm a Vice President of the Institute of International Affairs in Victoria. It's my very great pleasure today to introduce our speaker, Dr. Martin Umeboihi, who is the Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Ministry of Nigeria. Dr. Umeboihi, he told me that the way to get it right is to say, "Who may you be?" And I got it wrong. I'm sorry. he is Nigeria's senior diplomat as Permanent Secretary of the Foreign Ministry. He's had a very distinguished career in the Foreign Ministry, which he joined in 1984, serving subsequently in Belgrade, New York, and Addis Ababa, as well as the ministry in Abuja. Prior to becoming Permanent Secretary, he was the Permanent Representative of Nigeria to the United Nations in Geneva. Nigeria is a country that is on the other side of the curve for us. I was explaining earlier that for Western Australians, Africa, the continent of Africa, is much more apparent, is much more real. It's easy to fly to Africa, whereas for us on the eastern side, we are much more conscious, perhaps, of the Pacific and Asia. But Africa has become very much more in focus under the current government, and at least part of that, I suspect, is the fact that our foreign minister is a Western Australian. If you think of, our foreign minister, our former foreign minister is a Western Australian, and the former foreign minister was the one who began the push. Under the rule of the former foreign minister, we started to reorient our sights towards Africa. Nigeria is the largest country in Africa, one of the most influential countries in Africa. It plays an enormously important role, both bilaterally but also multilaterally in organisations like ECOWAS, the United Nations itself, the African Union, the Commonwealth, where we work closely with Nigeria in the Commonwealth. It's a country of the 21st, very much of the 21st century. Given its population, its talent, its oil wealth, it has been described as being the next one of the BRICS, that group of countries which will join in with Brazil, Russia, India and China. Nigeria is a country which is on the cusp of joining the BRICS. I'm not going to tell you any more about Nigeria. I'm going to hand over to our guest speaker, Dr. Umeboihi. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for that introduction. My name, again, if I may say it, and I want to call you on the pronunciation of my name, which requires a special lecture on its own. Umeboihi. Actually, it was in New Zealand. Yes, a New Zealander in Oxford who was a poet. In our first evenings, we went to just across my college to the Gardener's Arms, and we sat there entertaining ourselves to some beer. And he said, "Where are you coming from?" I said, "I'm coming from Nigeria." "Whereabout is that?" Of course, he was being provocative. So I think it just emerged from, just gained independence from Britain. I said, "Oh, I see. What's your name?" I said, "Martin." He took a sip. "What again is your name?" I said, "Martin, what is your name?" I knew he was looking out for something. So I said, "It may be difficult," because I want also to be very respectful. "It may be difficult for you to pronounce the name. What is your name? Can you write it for me?" So I wrote my son name for him, and he looked at it. So that's pretty easy. Who may you be? And ever since, I have provided that as an entry to my to discovering who this person is. But let me say how immensely delighted I am to be here this afternoon. I arrived here with my team since Sunday, and I've had a hell of a time, wonderful time. I've met various groups. I've also met a branch of this group in Sydney, and gave a paper which I hope I won't bore you. I will need to read to this branch because I think it's pretty extensive, and I took some time to work on it. But of course, I will be saying many things off the cuff because I'm 56 years old. That's still quite yesterday. And I've lived virtually all my life except for occasionally when I go out to work for my country. And for 3 years I was in England. Otherwise, I have been fully resident in Nigeria, born of Nigerian parents and of Nigerian ancestry. So I have also studied Nigeria and proselytized Nigeria. And I do that for a living, so you can understand it. But more importantly, I will speak the truth and nothing but the truth. Because I think it's important to present your country and portray your country without necessarily being sentimental about it, but also being realistic about what you say. So I have not come here to write a weak history of Nigeria, but to give a credible account of the happenings in my country. Once again, it is an honor and a privilege for me to be in Australia, my second to this wonderful country. I visited Australia first in 1995, and just like the first time, I'm amazed with the warmth, the serenity, and the irresistible beauty of this great country. I should like to express my profound appreciation to the Australian Minister of Foreign Affairs for including on my program an interaction with eminent members of this prestigious Institute of International Affairs. I'm excited at this opportunity because Australia is among leading countries that are making real impact on global affairs, on contemporary international politics. Our two countries, the Commonwealth of Australia and the Federal Republic of Nigeria, have had warm and friendly relations over many years. Both have equally collaborated on issues of international peace and security, democracy, human rights, the environment, among others, within the Commonwealth and in the United Nations system. As we continue to engage each other on issues of common interest and at various levels, the future trend points to even more robust and mutually beneficial relationship. My visit to Australia this time, to be followed by those of other senior officials of the Nigerian government in the near future, will certainly strengthen this growing friendship and genuine partnership. It is my pleasure to speak to you today on emerging trends on Nigeria's foreign policy. And I may slightly modify your title, the African Giant, because that is a title that I know I love giants, but being a giant doesn't necessarily mean that you are a positive force to be reckoned with. Not necessarily mean that, but it just expresses a potential. But I will modify that to read Nigeria's foreign policy in the post-Cold War era, issues, challenges, and future prospects. Of course, all of this will still enable you to comprehend perhaps why Nigeria has been described as an African giant. Giant because it is a country of huge potentials. 158 million black people. We didn't have settlers in our country, not because we never desired them, and not because we were not friendly. We had some mosquitoes and this was before the invention of quinine. So they were not able to deal with malaria. So they settled for the more humane climes either in the east or in the south. And so it happens by chance that Nigeria is today the seventh most populous nation on earth, but the most populous black nation on earth. Let me now say a few words about how I propose to lead this discussion. Following a brief examination of the global context of changing international relations, I will next focus on the domestic context of Nigeria's foreign policy making. The purpose is not merely to highlight the key actors and processes, but also to illustrate the historical and political underpinnings of policy making. Thereafter, I will proceed to examine some of the major issues on Nigeria's foreign policy trail. My main focus in that section will be on regional peace and security, African unity and solidarity, and multilateralism. Before concluding my presentation, I will speak briefly to the prospects of a reinvigorated Australia-Nigeria relations and why Australia must scale up its engagement with Nigeria and generally with the countries of our dear continent. So I'll speak first to the issue of the global context of Nigeria's international relations. Since the end of the Cold War, the world has gone through a series of major transformations. The unparalleled interconnectedness between societies and among states following the end of the Cold War has necessarily generated a fundamental shift in international relations. Now, as never before, nations have become tied to each other ever more closely through trade, through financial flows, sociocultural fusion, and the ever-growing revolution in information and communications technology. In the realm of international politics, the world is witnessing an increasing preference for multilateralism in place of hegemonic pursuit of global dominance by great power actors. This new world of international politics comes close to the admonition by John Donne, the 17th century English poet, who says that no man is an island entire to itself. Every man is a piece of the continent, a part of the main. Ironically, these far-reaching global changes have also generated fundamental paradoxes in global affairs. The first of these has been a resurgence of fierce nationalism and ethnicism, both of which have undermined the cohesion and stability of several states in Eastern Europe and much of Africa. The centrifugal forces that have been unleashed have proved particularly disruptive and unsettling to international peace and security. For instance, the brutal ethnic, religious, social, economic, and cultural conflicts that have ravaged much of the continent of Africa and the Balkans have led some scholars like Samuel Huntington to warn of a clash of civilization and the scepter of global disorder. Huntington's clash of civilization thesis was apparently an answer to Francis Fukuyama's end of history thesis, which characterized the end of the Cold War and the apparent triumph of Western liberal democracy as the end point of mankind's ideological evolution. Events, of course, have since proved these theories a little premature. The second paradox relates to the reemergence of regionalism. Whereas the end of the Cold War and the forces of globalization have facilitated increased dialogue and cooperation at the international level, regionalism has been revived in the hope that it might constitute the basis for an improved multilateral engagement. The new organizing principle of international relations now appears to be what Jay Nisbet, New Age mantra, said when he urged us all to think locally, act globally, think tribally, and act universally. The shift in the focus of great power politics from protecting client states to direct interference in the domestic affairs of developing countries is the third paradox of which I speak. In the transformation of global politics since the end of the Cold War, suddenly, issues such as the weakness in commodity markets, preferential tariffs for exports from developing countries, transfer of technology, to mention only a few, have virtually disappeared from the international agenda. Globalization has thus put paid to the principle of international development cooperation. The fourth paradox, which actually relates to the third, involves a fundamental shift in old policy. Increasingly, aid resources are being directed at addressing cross-border problems that are of direct concern to the donor countries, rather than for financing socioeconomic developments that could spur economic growth and alleviate poverty in developing countries. Finally, democracy has become universalized and made mandatory for state legitimacy. In the case of developing countries, democracy has become instrumentalized in the sense that it is now being promoted as a condition for donor support. This was how democracy in Africa came to be cynically categorized as donor democracy, meaning simply just enough fair voting and respect for human rights to satisfy the donor community. The cumulative impact of these paradoxes is that the benefits of globalization have largely bypassed the continent of Africa. For instance, many of the widely acclaimed benefits of globalization, such as more intensive and extensive integration of the global economy, increased international trade, and a rapid increase in the flow of capital and foreign direct investment, have largely been illusory for Africa. For the African countries, globalization's rewards have been limited to loss of policy autonomy and the intensification of the marginalization process. Although globalization has transformed the world into a global village, not everyone, unfortunately, qualifies for citizenship. This is the dilemma we face in Africa. Now to the domestic context of Nigeria's foreign policy. In a general sense, all foreign policies are the same, whether it is in Namibia, Nigeria, Vanuatu, Timor-Leste, wherever. If we conceive of foreign policy to constitute an attempt to design, to manage, and control the foreign relations of independent sovereign states, then you can say they are all the same. This is very much so because all national governments are faced with the same foreign policy challenge of how to respond to the demands and constraints of their regional settings, as well as the international environment. On the other hand, each foreign policy is unique, given the diverse and most times conflicting range of demands and responses nation states must pursue and must process in their international relations. These demands and responses, as we know them, are shaped by the global and regional settings in which these states operate, by national forces, by the process of policy making itself, and by what happens when foreign policy is implemented. The foreign policy of a country, therefore, occupies that ever-shifting and unpredictable terrain in which countries not only pursue and attempt to maximize their national interests, but also collectively promote international peace and security, friendship and solidarity, and economic development, including such universal values as human rights and democracy, among others. In general, a nation's foreign policy not only draws its authority, legitimacy, and mandate from its domestic priorities, its general orientation, vigor, and integrity are shaped by the history, the culture, and social values of its people. For a country's foreign policy to remain active and coherent, it must therefore be kept in tune with the aspirations of the nation and the peoples. A foreign policy which is delinked from the domestic priorities of a nation is like a broken-winged bird, at once castrated and incapable of flying. Such a bird can easily fall prey to predators. As it is with a bird, so it is with a nation state. For developing countries like Nigeria, poverty eradication, economic progress, peace and security, African unity and renaissance are some of the top priorities on the national agenda that necessarily shape foreign policy goals. In Nigeria, all the three branches of government, namely the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary, make varying degrees of inputs into the foreign policy process. There is, of course, a wide-ranging body of other stakeholders, including policy think tanks. We also have our Nigerian Institute of International Affairs, just like you have here. The mass media, business, and civil society, all of which contribute in shaping foreign policy. In other words, the political, legislative, and judicial institutions, civil society, and business generate views and perspectives that go into the making, the molded and the defining, and the conduct and management of foreign policy. These kinds of discourses and exchanges enhance the quality of Nigeria's foreign policy, particularly when it comes to the building of interstate institutions, the accession to and ratification of treaties and protocols. It must be understood that the processes of negotiation and ratification of international treaties and protocols not only constitute an important foreign policy activity. When duly ratified, these treaties dissolve into our domestic governance framework. From time to time, government also issues public policy directives and guidelines, which also give additional impetus to our foreign policy. All these processes generate the rules of engagement of Nigeria in international relations since independence. And I will now speak to the foreign policy objectives. Since independence, the principal source of Nigeria's foreign policy has been the Constitution of the Federal Republic of Nigeria, which prescribes for the Nigerian state five key foreign policy objectives. These objectives are specified in Chapter 11, Section 19 of the Constitution, states as follows. 1. Promotion and protection of the national interest. Promotion of African integration and support for African unity, the second objective. The third objective, promotion of international cooperation for the consolidation of universal peace and mutual respect among nations and the elimination of discrimination in all its ramifications. Fourth, respect for international law and treaty obligations, as well as seeking statement of international disputes by negotiation, mediation, conciliation, arbitration, and adjudication. And finally, the promotion of a just world economic order. Additionally, since a nation's foreign policy draws its vigor and its energy from its domestic or internal priorities, the federal government's Vision 2020, this was vision that was promulgated a couple of years ago, which in fact says that by the year 2020, Nigeria should be counted, would have achieved the status of one of the 20 most developed economies in the world. That's what we call the Vision 2020. Now, to achieve that, we have presented a slight accent on implementing the five objectives just enunciated. We've reduced that to five points, so that our foreign policy today aims to achieve put these 5 points on the front burner. First, the articulation of a positive image for Nigeria, as well as improving the country's relations with the outside world. Second, seeking closer and beneficial relations with the major powers. Thirdly, cultivating the acquisition and transfer of technology, including the promotion of trade and foreign direct investment. Fourthly, sustaining Nigeria's leading role in Africa. And fifthly, and finally, assisting Nigeria in securing a permanent seat in the UN Security Council. I hope in the course of our interaction, some of these questions around these may be raised, and I can provide some clarifications. So these are some of the high ideals and strategic objectives that drive Nigeria's foreign policy at this time. It goes without saying, therefore, that fidelity to these constitutional and policy mandates constitutes an article of faith, a received orthodoxy, so to speak, in Nigeria's engagement with the external world. Now, despite the evolution of Nigeria's foreign policy over the years, the basic organizing principle deriving from constitutional obligations have centered on the notion of four concentric circles of national interest priorities. At the core of these circles is a concern with Nigeria's own security as a nation, broadly defined to include the challenge of nation building, economic progress, and since 1999, democratic consolidation. The recognition of the fact that Nigeria's security, prosperity, and well-being of its citizens are inextricably tied to those of its immediate neighbors explains why a second cycle of interest is the security, stability, and prosperity of its immediate neighbors. In the first instance, and the entire countries of the West African subregion in that order. The achievement of this goal is rightly predicated on the cultivation of good neighborliness with Nigeria's immediate neighbors. In practice, this policy has been pursued within the framework of regional economic and security cooperation under the auspices of the Economic Community of West Africans, and that explains why Nigeria has never resorted to force or to military aggression or military intervention to resolve any of its difficulties or challenges with its neighboring countries. Within the same logic, continental Africa and Nigeria's engagement with the rest of the world, including multilateral organizations and partnerships, constitute the third and the final circles of our national interest priorities. It must be understood that the concentric circle approach is not simply a linear progression of foreign policy activities, but a policy roadmap whose objective is to introduce order and coherence and synergy in the policy-making process. Indeed, there is a considerable overlap among the four circles of foreign policy priorities that are consummated in the concentric circle thesis. It must be so because, in practice, the international environment is much more complex than the concentric circles, simply an orderly analytical construct of the international system, would appear to present. While the concentric circle approach does prioritize policy, it also recognizes the interdependence or interlinkages of all the spheres of interest. For instance, the achievement of Nigeria's security and prosperity cannot reasonably be pursued in an unstable regional or international setting. Likewise, the achievement of a just world economic order can be especially beneficial to the economic prosperity of Nigeria, and we realize this. The coherence and order imposed by the concentric circles of prioritization of foreign policy goals are largely responsible for much of the consistency and bold and positive actions that have characterized Nigeria's foreign policy since October 1, 1960, the year of our independence. Nowhere is this consistency more manifest and more self-evident than in the promotion of peace and security across the African space. The policy trend of objectivity and independence, historically expressed through membership of the Non-Aligned Movement, for instance, was intended to insulate the country from the insidious fallouts of great power politics during the Cold War era. Nigeria, unlike most other countries, chose to pitch their tent with America when it's with the West when it suited them, and with the East when it suited them. But Nigeria chose to be non-aligned and to be friends of all when its national interests are concerned, and see what disaster happened with the demise of the Cold War to states such as Somalia that have never recovered from participating unwittingly in Cold War politics. The Cold War is long dead, but objectivity and independence remain cardinal principles of Nigeria's foreign policy practice. The basis of this independence was laid by our first Prime Minister, Abubakar Tafawa Balewa of blessed memory, who, while addressing the Parliament weeks before Nigeria's independence in 1960, noted as follows, and I quote, "Nigeria would follow an independent policy which would be founded on Nigeria's interests and would be consistent with the moral and democratic principles on which the country, Nigeria's constitution, was based," end of quote. During a debate in the Federal House of Representatives on 14th January 1960, Prime Minister Tafawa Balewa restated Nigeria's policy of principled independence in foreign policy and made clear that Nigeria's assumption of statehood and responsibility for the conduct of its foreign policy was a privilege that would be taken with all sense of seriousness and responsibility. This core principle has held over time, the main elements of which have been: 1, reciprocal respect and legal equality of all states; 2, non-interference in the domestic affairs of other states; and 3, the principle of state sovereignty. It is instructive to note that no Nigerian government, either military or civilian, and you know we've had a spate of military intervention until 1999, has deviated from these cardinal principles of our foreign policy. I can therefore say with confidence that Nigeria has a proud record of substantial achievements and continuity in foreign policy practice that is comparable to any country's. Of course, this is not to say that there have been no important shifts in policy. However, whatever shifts that have occurred have merely been shifts in emphasis and not deviation from fundamental principles, goals, and objectives. In general, therefore, the adjustments that have taken place have largely been driven by a need to assert Nigeria's position as a regional power in the continent of Africa, especially from the late 1970s, when the liberation of the southern African countries from colonial rule and the struggle against apartheid in South Africa became an overarching goal, foreign policy goal of Nigeria. What this shift in emphasis does illustrate is that when the issues are unambiguous, as for example, when the interests of Africa or the dignity or the equality of all races, black, white, or yellow, are concerned or are at stake, Nigeria can be bold, firm, and assertive. Our objective has always been to negotiate the best possible outcome for Africa in the belief that if Africa does well, Nigeria will necessarily do just as well. By way of summary, let me say, I should like to emphasize that Nigeria has always been seen itself and has been perceived by others as a major player of significance in the game of international politics. Consequently, its views have always been sought on wide-ranging issues of concern to Africa, particularly issues of peace and security, without exception. Policymakers in Nigeria have always been keenly aware of the desirability of being positively neutral in international relations. However, because of Nigeria's extensive political and economic ties with the West, this neutrality has tended to tilt towards the Western world. In reality, however, Nigeria has always acted in what it considered to be its supreme national, and I may also add, global interest. The main issues in Nigeria's foreign policy. Some of the greatest success stories in Nigeria's foreign policy have been in the decolonization process, the anti-apartheid struggle, and more recently, regional peace and security. Using ECOWAS as a regional security vehicle, Nigeria has provided strong leadership in peace efforts across the African continent, across the West African subregion, notably in Liberia and Sierra Leone. And I recognize the Liberian born with whom I had a few conversations just before this meeting. Nigeria's leadership in the ECOWAS military observer group, ECOMOG, indeed broke new grounds in regional peacekeeping, making the two celebrated cases, that is Liberia and Sierra Leone, as providing the first clear successful example of a regional organization in the UN parlance, spearheading UN-mandated peacekeeping operations in conflict situations. At their peak, these operations involved the deployment of some 12,000 armed personnel from Nigeria, at a time when Nigeria was under international sanctions, at a time when we were suspended from the Commonwealth. And we expended as much as $12 billion in Liberia and Sierra Leone, lost over 2,000 Nigerian lives. But it was important that we had to do that to have peace in those countries. Beyond the West African neighborhood, Nigeria has always been active in various peace and conflict resolution initiatives across Africa, including Chad 1979 to 1982, Somalia, Democratic Republic of Congo, among others. Today, the most current examples of Nigeria's role in UN-mandated peacekeeping operation is indeed in the troubled Darfur region of the Sudan, where we have in place some 3,400 Nigerians. Here, Nigeria is providing not only a substantial number of military personnel and leadership, but also robust diplomatic support to the peace process, notably in the hosting of several peace conferences aimed at finding the last political solution to the lingering crisis in that part of Africa. At the last count, Nigeria has some 4,500, as I just said, peacekeepers serving under various United Nations mandates in several conflict theaters across the world. Indeed, on behalf of regional security, Nigeria has undertaken tasks and incurred huge costs, both in human and material terms, that even major world powers have found prohibitive. To this, I may just add that we have a program in our continent which is called the Technical Aid Corps Scheme, which provide expertise at Nigeria's cost to the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. This was begun in 1986 and has become so popular that it's now been mainstreamed into the UNDP of the United Nations because we found that Nigeria can collaborate with the UNDP in third countries to provide expertise and skills to those countries that may need them in the African, Caribbean, and Pacific regions. As experts in the field of peacekeeping will testify, Keeping the peace is an incredibly expensive venture, not only in terms of dollars and cents, but crucially in terms of human lives. Australia is also a major peacekeeping nation, and you probably will understand what we mean when I say this. Whereas financial aspects of member states' contributions to UN operations may be defrayed by the organization, the cost in terms of human lives cannot be remedied. The ECOMOG operations in Liberia and Sierra Leone, which I have alluded to already, got some $12 billion United States dollars of Nigeria's taxpayers' money, on top of some 2,000 lives that were lost in those incidents. UN operations in Somalia have also been bloody for Nigerian soldiers, as it is for other troop contributing countries. These are just a few examples of Nigeria's sacrifices in furtherance of regional and international peace and security. If I may just speak quickly to the economic and political renaissance in Africa and Nigeria's part in that. Nigeria's Afrocentric foreign policy has manifested in various ways, including lead roles in the creation of the OAU, now defunct, the African Union, which is now in place, New Partnership for Africa's Development, NIPAD, the Pan-African Parliament, and the CSSDC, the Conference on Security, Stability, and Peace in Africa. In addition to its strong and decisive role in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa and the independent struggle of Zimbabwe, and I regret that Zimbabwe is not very much what we thought it would be at this time, in Angola, Mozambique, Namibia, Nigeria was the primary driver behind the formation of ECOWAS. These are our role on the economic side. In regard to the decolonization process, Nigeria's bold step in the nationalization of the British petroleum assets in 1979 was a costly thing for us to do, but we did it to encourage Britain to move on to the Lancaster Conference and discuss the fate of Zimbabwe. And it happened. For that, we suffered some collateral damages. I will not discuss those now. But it was important that that was done and that Nigeria was ready to do that to bring about a decolonization, which was our interest. Addressing the UN General Assembly in 1979, the Nigerian head of state, General Olusegun Obasanjo, as he was then, made this statement, and I will just beg your pardon to refer to it. Quote, "I consider it imperative to sound a note of warning that Nigeria will never be a party to any solution in Zimbabwe that can be remotely interpreted as a sellout of the 6 million people of that land. Our objective is the unequivocal surrender of power by the minority of that population," end of quote. Thanks to Nigeria's singular resolve, the British government was able to convene the Lancaster House Conference, which successfully negotiated Zimbabwe's independence. I was in Oxford in the time of the Lancaster Conference, and Mugabe came to speak to us. But some of the things we now see in those parts don't quite match some of the aspirations we thought we would have of a free and independent Zimbabwe. But we can deal with that during the interactive stage. In a similar vein, Nigeria had earlier broken ties with France in 1961. You recall when France carried out some nuclear tests in the desert. Nigeria was one of those countries that severed diplomatic relations with France for defiling the desert. Nigeria's uncompromising stance against racism and colonial rule in Africa ended long-term chairmanship of the UN Special Committee Against Apartheid. In a rare demonstration of appreciation for its commitment and sacrifice towards the anti-colonial struggle, Nigeria was designated as a frontline state, by which honor Nigeria was reckoned with as one of the states in the front line of the fight against apartheid and colonial rule in Southern Africa. This honor, quote, implied a readiness by Nigeria to suffer collateral damages and other costs associated with anti-colonial struggle in the Southern African region. Coming nearer home, ECOWAS. ECOWAS remains Nigeria's boldest attempt yet to build economic and security linkages among countries of the West African subregion. With poverty the single biggest challenge confronting Nigeria and our West African neighbors, ECOWAS' original mandate sought to integrate the economies of West African states so as to improve the quality of life of community citizens. ECOWAS has since been transformed from being a regional vehicle for the economic transformation of West African states into a viable regional security provider thanks to Nigeria's leadership. The gradual transformation of ECOWAS into a regional security apparatus correctly reflects the objective situation on the ground in West Africa at this time, where poverty and insecurity sit side by side, feeding on each other, so to speak. The point I should like to stress is that despite the celebrated achievement of ECOWAS in the field of peace and security, escaping the conflict trap has proved particularly daunting for the West African countries. Among other factors, these countries are too poor, too weak, and too dependent on outside powers and interests to be able to shape a distinct regional agenda, including the capacity to develop cooperative security and developmental outcomes. Of all the countries of the region, perhaps only Nigeria is capable of providing of projecting power beyond the national borders. This probably explains why the Venerable Henry Kissinger has singled out Nigeria and South Africa as Africa's indispensable powers. According to Kissinger, and I quote him, quote, "No state except Nigeria or South Africa is in a position to play a major role outside its immediate region. African security issue should be left largely to African nations, with Nigeria and South Africa playing the principal roles," end of quote. Playing the role of regional leader has involved huge costs and sacrifices for Nigeria, but the country remains committed to these goals, because anything to the contrary would be an abdication of legal obligations imposed by its constitution. One way in which Nigeria pursues its foreign policy, and I'm speaking now to multilateral diplomacy, is through an extensive network of multilateral diplomacy, especially within the UN and regional organizations. At the multilateral level, Nigeria has established credible credentials both as a supporter and promoter of key issues on the global agenda, including but not limited to human rights, disarmament and arms control, international peace and security, reform of the United Nations, among others. Nigeria's substantial involvement in the work of the United Nations underscores its capacity and will to fulfill its obligations under the United Nations Charter. This is why, as the biggest black nation in the world, Nigeria believes it is only fair she represents Africa on the reformed United Nations Security Council in a permanent capacity. We can discuss this at some length in the course of our interaction. Nigeria has amply demonstrated through its track records that it could speak, act forcefully, and promote Africa's interests at all times. Now, let me speak to some of the challenges that we face as Nigeria on the foreign policy scene. Nigeria's relations with its neighbors have largely been friendly. One clear manifestation of maturity in the conduct of Nigeria's foreign policy is the commitment of successive administrations in Nigeria to a policy of good neighborliness, rather than give in to bellicose public rhetoric to throw its weight around. A keen awareness of Nigeria's preponderant power attributes in relation to its neighbors has permeated Nigeria's foreign policy in its West African neighborhood and beyond. The most prominent manifestation of the principle of good neighborliness relates to the dispute with Cameroon over the Bakassi Peninsula. You have a map of Africa here, Nigeria here. At independence, it was actually like this. But gradually, first there was a referendum in 1961, part of southern Cameroon. I can't vouch for the referendum, how transparent and how credible it was. But we lost a bit of it. That was okay for Nigeria. Then recently we had a very protracted misunderstanding with Cameroon, our neighbor. And we knew some powers were predicting that we're going to have a showdown with Cameroon. But Nigeria never. We went to the International Court of Justice, and the court decided to award the land to Cameroon, and we said, take, for the sake of peace. Be that as it may, looking at all of this, we have some formidable challenges. One of the greatest challenges Nigeria's foreign policy faces relates to how to mainstream the development agenda in foreign policy. Whereas all diplomacy clearly has an economic side to it. The so-called bread and butter issue. What is required is to mobilize the foreign policy apparatus in the service of Nigeria's development as envisaged under the Vision 2020, to which I have already referred. Since foreign policy is an extension of domestic priorities, the aspirations of citizens, one other big challenge for Nigerian diplomacy is how to articulate and vigorously market the country as a conducive place to do business. Everybody outside Nigeria, in Europe, and should I say in Australia, is unsure of what Nigeria looks like. Who are these guys who live in those places? Am I going to survive if I go there? Will I come back? I just want to assure you, you will come back. But we are trying to deal with an image challenge. And many of us Nigerians don't really understand how this came to be. I don't subscribe to the conspiracy theory of history. But from the evidence that's available, it would seem to me that there are some people somewhere who specialize in vilifying and misrepresenting Nigeria for career. I just hope that that is not the case. Because many good things are happening in Nigeria. Many, many good things. And in the course of our interaction, I would like anyone to seek clarification from me and indicate to me anywhere in the world, on the international scene, that Nigeria has disappointed the world. From the seventh day after our independence, Nigeria led the first United Nations peacekeeping operation in our continent to the Congo in the DRC. We know the history and the origins of the Congo. You know how the Congo was concocted by a guy called Leopold, who carved out this huge chunk of territory the size of Western Europe and called it a country. So, and this country became choked up in Cold War politics and the scramble of the Cold War era. And the rest, of course, is history, which we can talk about, but I don't want to be distracted. So let me just say that Nigeria wants to see Australians in Nigeria. In an era of globalization, Nigeria has no choice but to adjust and adapt in the way it conducts foreign policy. Have I left out a very important line? The important line that I have left, given the nexus between security and development, the overriding imperative for government must be to ensure sustainable peace and security, nurture a culture of democracy and the rule of law, so as to promote peace and stability without which economic growth and development will be greatly imperiled. The greatest challenge that the continent of Africa faces is not, we have discovered, it's not lack of resources. The bane has been governance. Governance. And I'm happy to announce that many countries in the continent have understood this now and are committed to promoting credible governance. In an era of globalization, and I will speak to our elections and the preparations for elections, that's why I'm cutting my stay short in Australia, because I have to leave here today so that I can vote on the 2nd of April. In an era of globalization, Nigeria has no choice but to adjust and adapt in the way it conducts foreign policy. For instance, the global nature of such challenges as climate change, terrorism, and transnational crimes renders these cross-border issues impossible to ignore and prudent to reflect in foreign policy formulation and governance at the domestic level. Accordingly, Nigerian foreign policy must keep a watchful brief on all these emerging threats and pay close attention to their wider ramifications. Perhaps I should add that Nigeria will not pursue a robust multilateral diplomacy at the expense of our bilateral relationships. That's why I'm here. We will therefore continue to build and deepen our partnerships with friendly countries, including Australia. In all cases, these relations will continue to be anchored on mutual respect and mutual responsiveness. If I may say, I should now make a brief comment on the political crisis in Cote d'Ivoire. I see in one of your flyers there reference to Libya. And I may also speak to those issues during interaction. By now, much of the world is familiar with the most recent political debacle in Cote d'Ivoire. The most significant being the inauguration of two presidents, two prime ministers in one country. I want to see where else that record has been beaten. This is a rather unfortunate development, precisely because the electoral process, which unraveled in early December 2010, was expected to be the culmination of a long-drawn process to unify and stabilize the country after years of internal strife. Nigeria, in its capacity as current chair of the Authority of the Economic Community of West African State, has been working and continues to work actively with other ECOWAS member states and with other countries in our continent to address this crisis within the context of the electoral outcome declared by that country's independent electoral commission and duly certified by the United Nations Special Representative of Cote d'Ivoire. I must stress that Nigeria's pursuit of an early end to this crisis is all about regional peace and stability, no more and no less. It is neither about regional dominance nor a policy of Pax Nigeriana, as is being mischievously peddled in some circles. May I now speak to Nigeria-Australia relations? Nigeria and Australia enjoy warm and friendly relations based on shared values as members of the Commonwealth and the United Nations. Flowing from this friendship and mutual understanding, the two countries have always cooperated at the bilateral level and at multilateral forums. Should Australia be bothered by what is happening in a country and in a continent distant, far removed from its sphere of influence? It's a multi-million dollar question. But I'll say, in a globalized world, local events and politics have assumed greater international salience. Issues of the rights of persons, energy, environment, migration, terrorism, and human suffering are universal challenges that affect us all, no matter where we are placed. Every day, our sensibilities are assaulted by pictures of disasters and sufferings around the world, which are beamed to our living rooms thanks to 24-hour television. Human suffering awakes in us the feeling of oneness of humanity and the need for us to look out to one another, not anymore in a war alliance, but now collectively against the violence of the elements of nature and oppression, wherever they may rear their ugly heads. I dare say then that Australia should be interested in Nigeria and in Africa. Our two countries will be better served if Australia looks far over the horizon to engage Africa and explore opportunities that are bound in this rather neglected continent. Happily, Australia has a new Africa policy of renewed commitment to Africa at this time. Australia has made clear that she wants to be part of Africa's future and to support the promotion of the continent's economic growth and prosperity through investment and trade. These we welcome. There is so much Australia can do to support economic and political reforms going on in Africa. Australia has also expressed interest in pursuing accelerated achievement of the Millennium Development Goals, as well as address peace and security challenges in Africa. I am happy that Australia has made clear that cooperation and dialogue with Nigeria will form an important part of this new Australia-Africa dialogue. We warmly welcome the new Australia-Africa initiative, in recognition of the fact that geography would no longer pose a barrier to fruitful conversation between Nigeria and Australia. Nigeria's position as a regional leader with enormous mineral and human resources are well documented. I therefore take this opportunity to invite investors from Australia to take advantage of the vast opportunities in Nigeria to do profitable business in the country. Trade between Nigeria and Australia is already on an upswing, increasing from a mere $302 million in 2009 to $628 million in 2010. The good news is that the scope for expanded trade is enormous, ready to be exploited for the mutual benefits of our two countries and our peoples. In conclusion, I have sought to elaborate here Nigeria's consistently positive role in international politics. Our capacity to do much more on the world stage has been enhanced by our democracy, which we are working hard to consolidate through elections this April. Whether as a member of the United Nations or the Commonwealth of Nations, or as a guarantor of peace and security in West Africa, and indeed in Africa, we in Nigeria believe that our partnership with friendly countries like Australia can help us promote a better world, where countries and peoples can live in peace to pursue their dreams under the protection of the rule of law. I thank you.
Well, thank you very much. That was a very comprehensive tour d'horizon of Nigeria's foreign policy. We have an opportunity for some questions. I'd like to finish the session at 2 o'clock if we can, so we'll have to be pretty quick. When you ask a question, can you please indicate your name and any organisation you might represent? Yeah.
Thank you, Liz. Bill
Pickford
of the Institute. We in the British tradition had over 800 years to grow in democracy, to understand and accept the rules of interplay. If you lose the election, you lose government, and these sorts of things. In Africa, it appears to be a very large learning curve that democracy is going along, and the stability of the democratic process to making Nigeria a nation, and the confidence of that, I would see as one of the leading things you could establish for Africa and people who are not used to it. Might I ask, how well does democracy work within Nigeria, and how deeply respected is and accepted? But it is from our point of view, not yours. Mm-hmm. So my question may not be quite valid.
Your question is very valid, if I may say so. And I like your reference to how many years it took Britain to go through the democracy curve. 800 years. We've been independent now for 50 years, and as indeed most African countries. And before that, they had endured 120 years or more of colonial rule. So we're talking about 50 years, and I'm a historian. 50 years in the life of a nation is not really much, objectively speaking. I was given a lovely present, indeed a treasure, in Sydney a couple of days ago by a Nigerian, one lecturer at Newcastle University. He had gotten this lovely treasure as a present from a Polish woman who's married to a Nigerian and who lived in Nigeria before independence. This publication that he gave me is titled A Souvenir Guard, Nigerian Independence Celebrations, Official Program, 1960. I have found it a treasure because it reveals where Nigeria was on 1st of October, 1960. There's a passage here titled Nigeria in Brief. And this souvenir was bought for 2 pennies at the time. And the first page here says, a souvenir to show to your grandchildren in the future. You're supposed to append your photograph here. And this guide was purchased by And Your Name in October 1960, when Nigeria became independent. So it has a passage here that is titled Nigeria in Brief, What's Happening Now? Now, of course, 1st October 1960. It said that the population of Nigeria is estimated at 34 million. This was 1960. Today, Nigeria is 158.7 million. 158.7 million. of which 19 million live in the north, 7 million in the west, 8 million in the east. Now, quite accurately says that there are about 250 different tribal and linguistic groups. Anthropologists and linguistic scholars have since updated that to 370 ethnic and national groups, speaking languages as distinct as Russia is from Chinese. Estimated population of the principal towns, let me just give an example with Lagos. Lagos was 350,000. Lagos today is 18 million.
What about Abuja?
Abuja is 3 to 4 million. And in 15 years, as a new city. Road mileage totals at independence, 37,000. Of which about 6,000 miles are classed as A roads. So the only tarred roads in Nigeria, 6,000 miles, in a geographical space of almost 1 million square kilometers. It says more than 2.5 million children aged between 6 and 12 attend the Federation's 16,000 primary schools. So the peoples of Nigeria had 16,000 primary schools. In my state, which is one of the minority states of Nigeria, I think today we have more than that in one state out of 37 states in Nigeria. There are also 477 secondary schools. Well, we have over more than 100 universities in Nigeria today. Over 1,000 students are enrolled at University College Ibadan. University College Ibadan was created in 1948 after the Second World War. And there were three of them, if you recall. Makerere in Uganda, Legon in Ghana, and Ibadan in Nigeria. But the number of students who were in the university in Nigeria, and the only tertiary institution in the country at that time, was 1,000. Today we have more than 100 universities in Nigeria, and I don't want to hazard a guess as to how many undergraduates or graduate students are going to school. But a study that I have done reveals that at any given school day in Nigeria today, you have more than 40 million Nigerians going back and forth from school. And this is the most laughable information that you will find in this book. Nigeria has 188 hospitals and 479 maternity and child welfare clinics, 623 doctors, and 34 dentists. I don't know how many Nigerian doctors work in Manhattan in the United States. There are about 100,000 lepers and 320,000 blind persons. I don't know how that will find a place in the brief history of Nigeria, but there you go. And I've read this in extenso just to make the point that we have not grown the way Nigerians would have liked Nigeria to grow since 1960, because these days you don't need to reinvent the wheel. The wheel is already there. But we've made huge progress, and progress given our own circumstances. First of all, trying to understand the multiplicity and diversity of the Nigerian polity. We fought a civil war for 30 months. But it was not the traditional civil war. It was not a war of disunity, a war to go our different ways. No. It was a war to stay together. It was a war of unity. And that war was not settled by the United Nations Peacekeeping Force, nor by the OAU Mediation Council. No, it was a war that was fought by Nigerians, for Nigerians, and reconciled by Nigerians. At the end of the day, the president at that time, a young man, General Yakubu Gawon, Sandor's trained, who was only 37 when the mantle of leadership fell on him, announced that there were no victors and no vanquished, and immediately commenced a program of reconstruction, reconciliation, and rehabilitation. Today, if you go to the eastern part of Nigeria, that was then Biafra, you will have no trace. In fact, those are some of the fiercest defenders of the Nigerian state today. So I think, without being overly critical, and without being seen, let me not be seen as making an apology for Nigeria, I want to say we haven't done too badly. And certainly, we can do a lot more. And that's why the framework of our global relations, how we conduct our business. And in international sphere, I think we've played a role far, far beyond anybody's imagination, in spite of the domestic challenges that Nigeria had. We didn't have democracy, but we went out and installed a democratically elected president in Sierra Leone. By a military government. And that goes to underline the distinction between that we must make as scholars between democratic demographies and democratic governments. They don't necessarily cohere. Nigerians are a democratic demography, instinctively federal by nature, and defensive of their freedom as individuals. Assertive, self-assured, very proud ancestors of three great empires. The Kanem-Bornu Empire, whose capital was in Maiduguri, that covered up to Libya. The Songhai Empire, whose capital was in Katsina, that stretched up to Mali and produced the University of Timbuktu. The Oyo Empire, whose spiritual center was Ile-Ife, and political capital was Oyo, but stretched as far as to Togo, and of course, the most important, where I come from, and you will permit me, where the world began, the Edo Empire, the Benin Empire, which was only conquered in 1897, following the British, Captain Phillips expeditionary force that came to Benin. So the point I am making is that we, as a people, we are naturally democratic people. But what has happened, the challenge of establishing democratic government has been to agree among ourselves that one man should be president. Why should I accept this man as president when I can be better than him? At least that's what he thinks. And that's what you have. But now we are reconciled to it, that one man must lead the ship at a given time. But you better leave after your term. As Obasanjo learnt, good man, he ruled for two terms. And he wanted to try a third. And he learned the lesson that he couldn't have a third term. So that's why we are also paranoid about Laurent Gbagbo, whom we insist must give up power because he lost in an election that was declared democratic and fair by both the United Nations, by ECOWAS, by the AU, and by the EU and everybody else. He had stayed on in power for 10 years without elections and agreed to a process, only to get to the end of the process and you say you are no longer part of it. Nigeria is leading the vanguard in ECOWAS as chair, that will not be. If you leave me, I can talk for.
One more question. Zara?
You talked of the nationalisation of the BP assets in 1997, and you also at the end very much emphasised that Nigeria encouraged foreign investment. Could you just tell me how something as important enough as to nationalise assets of a foreign company would not set a good precedent for foreign investment following?
I'll explain to you by an illustration. At the moment, we are all in the thick of trying to understand Libya and the unfolding situation in Libya. On that night, that fateful night of the UN Security Council resolution, there was a leader, or a purported leader, that had called its citizens rats and cockroaches, and promised, I was yelling through the television, that this night I am coming for you. I will go from room to room, and there will be no mercy. I had a conversation with our mission in New York. And they asked him, when will your instructions come? And I said to them, what instructions do you need? Nigeria's foreign policy, as I've illustrated to you, is very clear on what our values are. We don't second guess when it comes to freedom and when it comes to life. And no cost is too high for us to bear. It will hurt us, but we'll do it because the purpose of our participation in global affairs is to also help to save life. So we told our woman, vote your conscience and vote for life and vote for freedom. And I don't think we can play games with these terms. They're pretty clear what they mean. And freedom in that case was a country needed to be free. And how can we have nothing else to do except to say, look, please, if you don't do this to us, please don't also do business with us. Please, because we love freedom. And we think that the world would be a better place if we were all free. So, but that was what happened in that case. I think nations must understand what human rights are. And these never change. They're like truth. Truth is one. Truth is eternal. Truth has no color. Truth has no race. I believe if you stand with truth, you will always be right. But if you allow other considerations to becloud your vision of the truth, you may recognize it eventually, but it will take a while. So this is really how we operate globally. And we do this not because we are very comfortable doing it all the time. Nigeria is a developing country. We don't have the resources. As I said, we suffered huge collateral damages from all these things that we try to do. But we are better off, I think. At least our consciences are better off. And in the final analysis, that's what matters. Because we'll return to our rooms. I will leave this job in 4 years. But I'll go back to my village. Where, by the way, I'm a chief now. I'll go back to my village and read newspapers if I see them. And if we have electricity, I'll also watch the news. But I couldn't really care less if I didn't see.
Will you be dressed the same way?
No, definitely I won't wear a bow tie. That I guarantee you. But you know, it's a very quiet little village in my part of the world. But it's a lovely place. Very little stress in the place.
Where is it on the map?
On the map. Wow. It's somewhere here. And it's one of the places that produce oil. We're one of the south. We've been fighting for our right for a long time, but we now got it because the president is coming from that part of the world. So this is what I wanted to say on that. Let me give you some economic reports about Nigeria. I think I have to. Why I think the indices that we have, I see that in the flyer for this meeting, certain things are written about the indices from Nigeria. And there's a little more than that. I did look up a publication by two global investment companies, Renaissance Capital and Citigroup or Citibank, which published something about a month ago, that Nigeria is growing now at a sustained rate of 8.5% annually for the last couple of years, and this will continue. And that is bigger than India. India has 8. Nigeria's present contribution to the GDP is 0.5, global GDP. But by 2050, it's going to be 2.5%, and that is quite significant. Nigeria is not known because it is oil. That oil is not the greatest asset that we have. Some have even described it as a curse. Our greatest reserve is in gas and in solid minerals. Gas in Nigeria is estimated proven at 187 trillion cubic meters of proven gas reserve. And only last week, just before I came here, the president did launch a revolution with China, costing $25 billion. We think that the indications are good and that this great country has a lot of contributions to make and a lot of benefits also to share by increased participation and involvement in our economic efforts. So may I just wind up on that? Thank you.
Right, I will make one last question. Gentleman here.
My name is Tony Abbas. I want to actually see a Nigerian. I'm able to prove to the whole world that Nigerians are doing well. I mean, we're not known for bad things, you know. The concept of the way people see us. I just want to ask a question, and I'll first of all say something that happened to me. I had an appointment, and there is a new job. And while you were sharing a few things about Nigeria, and to be precise, I think it was a bit of a negative part of Nigeria that you were showing. I felt that the person that was conducting the sort of a video thing, sort of felt the way I felt. I said, Tony, don't worry, I live in the UK. I have a lot of medical doctors and the people in Britain and they were doing well. That is one aspect that I want us to do well in terms of that. And I know fully well what Nigerians living overseas are thinking about. It's affecting us greatly. And I know you're not sitting back, the government is trying its best. But I want to say at this stage that that work cannot be won without involving Nigerians in diaspora. It's very, very pertinent, Nigerians in the diaspora.
Right.
My question is basically, it's got to do with the first speaker. I'm an international student. I did international development here at my university, and I came across a few things while I was living in Nigeria and while I'm here. And I thought it's something I should share with Nigerians. I have this concept and I have this belief, I'm researching on it to say that we have a kind of reform that was brought to Africa. And since our independence, we have been following this reform, like the electoral process or processing we're going through, democracy. Democracy is not, it's going to take many, many years, like it indicated in the case of the UK. But I have this belief that we need to sort of look inwards and passionately away for ourselves in order for the democracy to grow. I'll give you an example. There is no way, and you know fully well, there is no way I will not vote for my dad if he's contesting for presidency, whereas the person contesting against my dad is credible. This is natural. Mm-hmm. I would come back to Australia. My neighbor was going to go, and we were going to vote in the local election. He said, Tony, this is my brother. I said, yeah, let's go and vote for him. You know what he told me? He said, no, he cannot deliver. I was crying like a baby, and I thought about my country. A lot of factors can contribute to this, like religious factor, maybe family allegiance, and that is the problem I'm thinking with facing in Africa. When we talk about corruption, let us look back at the reform we are using. I want people who are in charge of our people to look inwards and see if we can modify democracy.
Thank you, Toyin. I'm glad I have some sense of what Toyin Abbas is trying to ask. He's saying, first of all, we have an institution now that deals with diaspora. It's called NIDO, Nigerian in the Diaspora Organization. And there's a bill going through the Senate at this time at home, which intends to create a commission for NIDO. And we're saying that commission should be domiciled in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. With regards to our electoral process, elections for us now is just getting to 10, we've just done 10 years of successive elections, and three times. This is the fourth one we are doing now. But there is progress being made. I agree with you, yes, one should be able to say, look, I won't vote for this guy even if he's my father, but if he's not good enough, I won't have him. That's the rational thing to do. But we still have some way towards getting there. But I can say that in relative terms, the progress that Nigeria has achieved in the democratic evolution process has been really stunning for me. Who, President Goodluck Jonathan, where does he come from? This guy comes from this path.
Yeah.
No, where is it?
Down there.
Somewhere. Yeah, yeah, somewhere around here. In the creeks. He's not Yoruba, he's not Igbo, he's not Hausa. Now, that is a revolution. And how did he get there? Through a constitutional means. We had a serious threat to our democracy with the failure in the health of the last of his boss, his president, who died in office. And for a complex country like ours to come to a decision that we will use no other means, we follow the due process to get the vice president without any, we had no provision in our constitution for dealing with a dead president in office, none. So that could really have unraveled everything. But the country without president for many months, because he was sick for many months in Saudi Arabia, sick for many months in Europe, but the country held on. We just celebrated 50 years of our independence, but it was a celebration of resilience of a people. And Jonathan today, coming from that part, is defiling all predictions, and he's going to win. I'm not a politician. I'm just speaking to what I can see. Because Nigerians recognize that we must rise above these tendencies. We must rise above the tribe. We must rise above the religion. We must rise above favoritism or nepotism. We must rise above all these things and see how we can take our first foot forward. That's the difference between developing nations and developed nations, that they can make a distinction. So I am very optimistic at this, at the rate at which democracy is being consolidated in our country. In 3 weeks, we registered 72.5 million voters. 72.5 million voters are registered to vote in this election. That is bold, and that is a good sign. So I want you to look at this side of it while we address the other issues. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Uhumobi. I think we've had an opportunity to get a very clear outline of Nigeria's foreign policy, and I think that the questions were particularly illuminating on aspects of that you had raised during your speech. As an historian and a student of international relations and a practicing diplomatist, I hope that you will find this book, which is the history of the Institute of International Affairs, of interest. Thank you very much indeed.